Welcome to today's program titled, How I Learned to Stop Hating My Data and Love Records Management. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our hosts for today's call. Nancy Libben, you may begin.
Thank you, and thank you all for joining us for today's webinar, How I Learned to Stop Hating My Data and Love Records Management. We're going to talk today about information governance. We'll explain what an information governance program is, why you should have one, how to build one, some critical features that every organization's information governance program should have, and then we'll be happy to answer your questions along the way, as well as at the end. My name is Nancy Libben. I'm a partner in the Privacy, Security, and Technology Group at Davis Wright Tremaine in Washington, D.C. And before going back into private practice, I was the Chief Privacy Officer at the U.S. Department of Justice, where I worked on some of these issues from an in-house perspective.
And my name is Rachel Marmore. I'm a counsel in the Technology, Privacy, and Security Group based in New York. Before joining Davis Wright Tremaine, I was in-house for almost 6 years in the financial services industry and spent some time at a law firm prior to that as well. My specialty is data management and working with organizations regarding their privacy compliance practices. When I was in-house, I spent a lot of time working on information governance and e-discovery issues, and now translate that to helping numbers of clients put together programs. So I wanted to start by talking about what information governance is. Information governance is a lot more than records management. And I know this is a bit of a hot topic right now as new privacy laws are causing organizations to really dig into not just what data they have, but how they manage it and how they can do so effectively. We'll go over exactly what those laws are in a few minutes, but just to set the stage, information governance is the strategic management of information at an organization. It may include records management and having a records retention schedule, but it's a lot more than just the banal, how long do we keep this particular record. Information governance involves maximizing business value of specific information by knowing where it is, making sure that it's available and that from a business continuity perspective, you're not at risk of losing the information, as well as making sure that it's used in a responsible and profitable way for the company. It also involves minimizing the risk associated with the collection and storage of data. And I know as a lot of organizations are discovering as they dig into CCPA compliance, that there are a lot of risks associated with keeping things around for a long period of time. Some of them are regulatory risks, and some of them are security risks. The longer that you have things, the more information you have, the harder it is to protect all of that data. And finally, information governance is minimizing the cost associated with collection and storage of data. While the cloud has made long-term storage a lot cheaper for companies, it's still expensive, and often data can't be stored in the cloud because it's on some sort of media that would require conversion and is difficult for the company to actually go through with that. I've given you this little chart here. This is from EDRM, which is a really great resource for framework information about e-discovery and information governance. It's intended to demonstrate that information governance is a cross-functional activity. Often these exercises get driven by legal, or legal is a key partner in the leadership because of the legal risks and because legal is bearing the consequences of having all of this information in the company. But the reality is that it can't be done without these cross-functional stakeholders, particularly the business and IT, who make the decisions about what information to create and how it gets used in everyday business for the company. Why are we having this webinar about information governance? Why is now the time when your organization should start thinking about it? The reason is that information governance is going to be your secret to responding nimbly to privacy requirements and reducing long-term costs and risk. So when you're digging into CCPA compliance, for example, CCPA as California Consumer Privacy Act, just in case folks don't know the acronym, you can write a checklist and you can say, I need to do this privacy policy and I need to know how I'm going to respond to this particular request for access and I need to do employee training. Boom, boom, I'm done. And you can technically be in compliance with the law if you do that. But the reality is that it will be extremely onerous for you to comply with the law and that you won't have a good sense of the accuracy or quality of your compliance if you don't dig into the data, the practices behind your data management. Information governance can help you future-proof your privacy compliance program, really prepare you for not just California, but what might come down the pipeline in Washington or Illinois, which has a new draft bill out, or New York, or whatever is to come from the federal government in the future. Because if you know where all your data is and you're being strategic about who can access it, where you're putting it, and how long you're keeping it, you're going to be well positioned to incorporate any new requirements into your program. Robust data management is also good for business. And this is sometimes an argument that gets forgotten in the discussion about legal risk. We live in the era of big data. More and more tools and techniques exist now to analyze your data to lead to better business operations. And so knowing what you have and what the quality of that data is will help your businesses figure out more creative ways to drive their own profits. Finally, information governance reduces security costs and lessens risk of breach. According to the IAPP, 85% of breaches are caused by human error. Some of that is human error that lets an intruder enter your system, but a lot of that is human error that leads to information being emailed to the wrong recipient, ending up on the wrong server, somehow leaving its access-controlled areas. And information governance, first of all, tries to get rid of information when you don't need it so that you don't have this risk of human error. And second of all, tries to reduce human error by using technologies and a series of controls to keep those errors from happening or to cause them to error out when they do instead of actually going through. The risk of breach is becoming even more important with the implementation of the CCPA next January because organizations that experience data breaches could face class actions and will be subject to statutory damages if certain sensitive data is breached.
So continuing in the theme of why we need to have an information governance program, as was mentioned at the beginning, there are a number of different data privacy and security requirements that companies have to comply with. For instance, last year, the European Union's General Data Protection Regulation came into effect, and as Rachel mentioned, California enacted the California Consumer Privacy Act, which goes into effect on January 1st of next year. In addition, the state of Maine just enacted a new privacy law that will apply only to internet service providers that goes into effect next year as well. These laws variously require companies to do a number of things, including limit the personal information that they collect, limit how they use that information, delete the information when it's no longer needed for the purpose for which it was collected, give consumers access to personal information they've collected, correct inaccurate information, delete information upon request, and notify service providers that information must be deleted. In addition, a number of states also have different data disposal obligations that require companies to take certain action with respect to personal information and other data they've collected. It is very costly and difficult, if not impossible, for companies to comply with this multitude of requirements if they don't have some sort of information governance program in place. And because, as Rachel mentioned, noncompliance can trigger hefty fines and certainly trigger bad public relations, it behooves companies to invest the time and resources into developing an information governance program to avoid legal exposure. I think a number of companies really addressed this for the first time last year when they struggled to get into compliance with the GDPR. The GDPR applies to U.S. companies that offer goods and services to people in the EU, and many U.S. companies for the first time found themselves having to address the full range of fair information practice principles that undergird the GDPR and other kinds of omnibus privacy laws around the globe. And in doing so, we worked with a number of clients that had to, for the first time, conduct a data mapping exercise, which Rachel will talk about, and put in place at least a semblance of an information governance program to enable them not only to comply with the GDPR at that time, but also to situate them to adapt to changes in that law as the law evolves. And also, as Rachel noted, this will help them future-proof their operations to prepare and comply with, to prepare for and comply with future data privacy laws.
I was talking on mute. apologies for that. So now that we've established why we want to have a good information governance program, we want to dig into what a good information governance program entails. And as I mentioned, true information governance is a lot more than having a piece of paper that says we should keep X documents for a certain period of time. When we're building our information governance wall, the bottom block is knowing what your data is. And knowing what your data is can be really challenging, as we'll talk about when we get into data mapping. But it's critical to have some baseline of understanding and measuring what is within your organization. And the even harder part is it has to be some baseline that is capable of being updated on a constant basis, because what information you have and how it is used by your business is constantly changing. Once you know what your information is, then you can start to think about all the different things that are important in how you manage your data. Often, organizations approach this from the perspective first of wanting to get rid of data. And we call that defensible disposal because we know you all don't just want to take your hard drives out to the alley and bang them with a baseball bat, but that you want to think through things like legal hold and other records retention requirements that might be in place and make sure that you're only getting rid of what you actually need. And it can often be very tempting to say, I want to do that first. I want to get rid of a bunch of stuff. And in some organizations, depending on how you saved your data, it may be possible to identify pockets of low-hanging fruit. Old backup tapes are a really great example of data that often you don't need to query, you may not need to worry about. You can just take a big box out and get rid of it. Please do that securely, by the way. We can talk about that later. Having said that about defensible disposal, it can be very tempting to want to start with getting rid of data, but the reality is if you don't address your data management before you start deleting, that the minute you start deleting and probably spend a lot of money trying to figure out what your data is before deleting, you're going to be creating new data that you're then also not going to know what that is and is also not going to be controlled, and you're going to have to spend a lot of money a year from now going through the same process that you went through previously. So what we recommend before you start deleting is get all your policies in place, get your governance structure working, and then you can get into disposal. Governance structure, as I mentioned, good data governance requires people from a number of different groups. Often lawyers look at this and say, this doesn't feel legal to me. This seems like a business issue. Why should this be led by legal? Why should legal take a leadership role here? And the answer to that is that legal has a large role to play in data governance because legal understands the consequences of holding too much data or not having the right data management in place. We see those consequences every day in our litigations when instant messages pop up in discovery that say things that are unflattering for our company, and we really wish that we had better policies that kept those from being created in the first place or kept them from being around 7 years later when that litigation actually was filed. And we see this from a security perspective when we're dealing with data breaches or inadvertent disclosures, again, of information that probably shouldn't have been used in that way in the first place. IT has a role here because they technically know not just what the data is, but what the format is in which the data is stored and how it can be managed or gotten rid of or tracked. But IT is not always the expert on the risk, or IT is not always the expert on the business use. The business side plays a role here because they know what the data is and they know what they need it for. Often, however, the business side is not aware of the consequences of the decisions that they make regarding data because it is only legal who's seeing and bearing those consequences. So it's important to bring all those groups together in some sort of permanent structure in order to start addressing data management within your company. Data minimization is a term that comes from GDPR, although has origins much beyond that, that refers to only creating the data that you need for the business purpose for which you're creating data. So if you are trying to evaluate employee retention, for example, not creating information, not tracking information that you wouldn't actually use in an analysis of employee retention. And data minimization goes hand in hand with privacy impact assessments, which is a term that comes from the now failed Washington Privacy Act that was on the table earlier this year, but is a really good term and also jives with a GDPR requirement for data protection impact assessments. What privacy impact assessments are is a process that a business would have to go through both when coming up with new ways to use data and then on some sort of regular basis with regard to ongoing use to assess what the privacy concerns are with regards to what they're doing and whether they can accomplish their goal in any means that would be less impactful on privacy. And they can be incredibly tedious, and it takes a while within an organization to get people used to doing them and used to analyzing data use in a particular way. But it's really the only way that the risks associated with data can be fully evaluated and the only way that legal can get a complete picture of the risk within their organization. Information governance is also going to involve policies and procedures that set forth best practices for data management. And those best practices start with defined ownership of data, that for information to be created within a company, somebody has to step up and say, I'm going to take responsibility for what happens with that information throughout its life cycle. This is actually really tricky concept in a lot of organizations, because what happens is that you get multiple business lines or groups or divisions wanting to share a particular technology good. For example, within an organization, there's usually only one instance of an email server or exchange. There may be multiple servers behind the scenes, but it all works together within one system. And oftentimes, IT looks at that and says, well, the business owns data in this organization. We can't make decisions. We don't know what emails is used for. And each individual business looks at that and says, nobody's ever asked me to make a decision about electronic communications before. I don't know, you know, what the infrastructure is and how we would go about getting rid of this and what the regulatory regime is. And this is where it's important both to have a structure that puts people in charge of those decisions and to have that cross-functional structure so that nobody can sit in a room by themselves and say, that's not my job. Along with ownership come access and storage controls. And access doesn't just mean keeping people out who don't need to be in the database, but putting some controls around how the information is used. And I think this is the biggest challenge that a number of our clients have had to respond to as they really dig into privacy compliance, that the laws require you to use data for particular purposes, disclose those purposes, not use data for any purposes that you haven't disclosed, and give individuals rights to demand that their data be deleted, except when it's used for a more narrow set of purposes. And the only way as an organization that you can comply with transparency and know whether you're allowed to keep data is if you know how your data is being used and have the capability to say certain types of sensitive data or certain types of data for which customers would like us to not keep, we can only use for specific purposes, and we can guarantee that when it's sitting in the X database that people are only going in there and able to use it for those purposes. Hand in hand with access comes storage controls. In order to put those access controls around data, it has to be stored in a particular database. Storage also feeds into a good records retention practice. If you are required to keep your tax returns for 6 years, for example, but you don't tell people where to put the tax returns, there's no way to actually implement that policy. And I think that's where a lot of records retention schedules fall down or fail to actually impact an organization's behavior, because they don't tell people what they're supposed to do with the information to distinguish information that needs to be saved from information that needs to be doesn't need to be saved, or information that is sensitive from information that is not sensitive. Storage controls are also critical to privacy compliance. The new privacy laws, GDPR, CCPA, and other emerging laws allow consumers to write to a business and require the business to provide to them a complete copy of all of the information that the business has kept about them. Well, if you don't know where your data is stored, you cannot respond accurately to that request, period. And then you are violating the law. And if you don't control where people can store information, and they can create spreadsheets about individuals and store them on any shared drive in the company, there's no way to comply with your legal obligations.
So, while implementing an information governance program might seem daunting at the outset, that's a lot. Rachel went through a lot of very important tasks that have to be managed and completed in order to put in place a strong program. While that may seem daunting, it will pay off and principally will help with not just compliance, but as the other side of the coin of compliance is risk mitigation. And it's going to help you mitigate a number of key business, legal, and reputational risks that your company faces in the absence of such a program. So data is really the lifeblood of most organizations in our digital economy. And as Rachel noted, knowing what data your organization has and where it's held will enable you to use that data effectively to drive your business decisions and to gain or keep your competitive edge. It's also critical to business recovery in the event that your business suffers an incident or there's some sort of a disaster that brings your systems down and that interferes with your operations. And of course, knowing what the company's critical data assets are and where they're held is essential to recognizing if those crown jewels have been compromised and to ensuring that appropriate security safeguards are in place to protect them. Good information governance also mitigates legal risk. We've talked about that earlier, the laws that are on the books that require companies to provide all manner of access, correction, and deletion rights, as well as to implement adequate security safeguards. Information governance programs serve as the internal infrastructure that enables companies to comply with these requirements. And by mitigating the risk of security incidents, companies can also protect their officers and directors from shareholder derivative suits, which plaintiffs have brought against public companies that suffer security breaches. And finally, because good information governance mitigates the risk of privacy and security incidents, it also mitigates the risk of reputational damage that we can see when companies suffer some sort of an incident. The negative publicity that companies receive, and we see this all too often in the media, can damage a company's brand, lead to lost customer trust, and have a negative impact on the stock price. So the first step in developing an information governance program is identifying what your requirements and obligations are so that you can construct a program that ensures you can meet those obligations. There are several potential sources of these obligations. You should identify the laws and regulations that your company is subject to so that you can set the standards that your governance program should meet. You also may be subject to self-regulatory codes of conduct or principles, particularly if you're in the online advertising space. And of course, all companies have contractual obligations that require them to handle personal data in certain ways. These two must be identified and defined, and doing all of this will help you identify gaps between your current business practices and your obligations so that you can fill those gaps with good information governance practices to ensure compliance and mitigate your risk. You'll also need to identify your pain points. Where are the gaps in your knowledge and understanding of and control over your company's data processing? This is really a critical first step in developing your information governance program. Does your organization collect and store data that you weren't aware of? And is there a documented business need for the data? Do you know where your data is stored? Who has access to it? And do all of these people really need to get access to that data? Rachel talked earlier about the risk of wrongful access, even if it's well-meaning. It's important to make sure that you limit access, internal access to the data, to people who have a need to access it. Do you maintain data longer than you need? Most companies have a tendency to hang on to data when it's no longer necessary. Not only do some laws, as I noted earlier, require that you dispose of the data, but as Rachel noted, doing so is a good practice, and it mitigates your risk so that you don't suffer a breach.
And I'll add to that, Nancy, that I think an important part of defining objectives is just the project management and building your business case aspect, that it takes a long time to get these programs up and running in organizations. And at least from my personal experience, it can be a long, painful time. And you have to put together a lot of slide decks that explain to your supervisors, your general counsel, their bosses, why they should spend money on something that to them doesn't look like it's going to directly materialize into profit. And I think that defining the objectives of your program can be helpful in allowing you to see whether there are quick wins that your program can address in the first 6 months or year, because let's also be honest, this is going to be a multi-year program, so that you can show, interim value to your managers. And it also lets you crystallize the risk. Your organization might have done data mapping. You might have a fairly good sense of what data you have, and therefore risk of inaccuracy on consumer transparency or consumer responses, maybe that's less of a concern for you. But maybe you have an entire warehouse of boxes and legacy data is a huge problem that needs to be addressed. These all are going to be slightly different depending on your organization, and it's important to start by knowing what problems you're trying to solve. So there is a question that I will read aloud to the group. We do not have in-house expertise to build an information governance program. What kind of consultants should we look for? I think that question goes well with my next slide, which is the people, process, and technology. I think the answer is going to depend on your organization and what, again, what your objectives are, what your budget might be, and what your timeline is. I do think consultants can play a really valuable role, particularly in the more technical aspects of figuring out what data you have, but there's also a large and often overlooked role for law firms here. And the way that law firms can help is by helping you really hone in on what your current risk profile is and what the gaps are that you need to resolve in order to mitigate that risk. And then they can help you take those legal requirements that Nancy talked about at the beginning of the slide and start to translate those to people, process, and technology requirements. And I think law firms are much better positioned than consultants to do this work, although some consultants are lawyers, so they might be fairly well positioned as well. But they are really well positioned because they have that familiarity with the law itself. And because when they do that work, where it is appropriate and where it is truly legal as opposed to business advice, then it gets cloaked in privilege. One thing that will happen, and we'll talk about this a bit more on data mapping, is if you haven't mapped data and you go out and you start to map your data, I would be willing to put money that you will find some treasure trove of sensitive information such as Social Security numbers or bank account numbers or credit scores in a place where they shouldn't be unsecured or kept for way longer than they should be based on business need or promises that you've made to consumers or employees. And when that happens, you know, it might be that it's just a security risk and you get rid of them, but it very well also might be that it's a legal violation. For example, if you have credit scores and they're being used for purposes other than which the consumer consented, that's a violation of FCRA. When you make that discovery that you are violating FCRA, you want that made within the cloak of privilege, again, if privilege is generally appropriate given the exercise. And you want the lawyers to be the people who are immediately reacting to that and giving you analysis of what you need to do, as opposed to consultants acting in a non-privileged capacity. I will say in consultants, too, there's a lot of different folks out there. And, you know, don't be afraid to be creative in who you're hiring. You don't have to hire the big four. They have a lot of value. But you can also look at, you know, leaner consultancies or more creative consultancies if your budget is a little bit smaller. So in terms of articulating the information governance program that you are trying to build, I tend to use the consultant people process and technology model. And I think that's important to emphasize because often I see organizations looking at one of those and not all three. And information governance doesn't work without all three. Particularly on the technology side, write this down, there are no easy buttons that are going to give you privacy compliance. There are some really, really awesome and valuable tools that can help you with data mapping, that can help you with flagging personal information or sensitive information on your systems on an ongoing basis. None of them are something that you can download an .exe file and press go and poof, you have data mapping. You need processes to make your technology run. You need processes that cause your technology to be executed on a regular basis, that call for the evaluation of the results that the technology has found, and that call for documentation of what you're doing so that you can defend to a regulator what you did to protect your information. And then you need people to execute those processes. And I think one of the biggest, you know, pain points in a lot of organizations is that there aren't people whose responsibilities it is to keep data in order, because historically that's not been thought of something that drives profit for organizations. But without people who aren't just assigned to those roles but have the right expertise and have real career incentives to do them well, all of the great processes in the world aren't going to matter. So, as we've mentioned a number of times, the first step in information governance is often data mapping. And I'm sure that you're all rolling your eyes right now and saying, like, do I really have to? You know, I installed a program last year and I sent out a bunch of surveys and I didn't get very good results and all my business people got mad at me and I really like to not deal with that again. Okay, thanks. And we hear that, and the first time I ever asked a technical person to create a data map, they laughed at me, and she's probably still laughing today, actually. But the reality is that some form of data mapping is required by GDPR. It is the black letter law of Article 30 that you have to have a processing register. You cannot be in compliance with GDPR if you don't have some form of a data map. It might be unrealistic to try to create one big spreadsheet that has every program that you're running in the company, or that tracks, you know, every single place where everything is used, given that unstructured data might be a big part of your environment. But you have to have some way of tracking what it is that you have, because otherwise you cannot comply with privacy law. going through a data mapping exercise can also be a really good way to identify some of the pain points that we talked about previously. So where you find personal information in unexpected places, you have to ask yourself why. Did this get here because there was a lack of ownership? Did this get here because there were a lack of storage controls? Did this get here because of a complete human error and nobody meant to save it here in the first place, but we didn't understand how the technology works? The data mapping can be really insightful in helping you build that list of problems that you have to solve in order to remediate your data. Data mapping, as I mentioned as well, requires ongoing collaboration between legal and IT. Good data mapping is going to start with defining the legal requirements. What do you need in order to satisfy privacy law and in order to implement the good information governance that we've been talking about? All too often, I see surveys that try too hard to get at the detail and don't think through, you know, how do IT people talk about their information and what is it that lawyers actually need to know and how do you translate between how IT people speak and how lawyers, and let's be honest, we don't know what we're talking about when we talk about data. How do you translate between what you know and how we think about things? And it's important to start that collaboration early and to have everybody at the table when you're designing the process, because if you send a garbage survey out, you're going to get garbage information back, and you only typically have the capital within your organization to do this once. If you're interested in more information about data mapping, we actually published a blog a couple of weeks ago, which is cited here, and I believe we're emailing the slides out so that you don't have to try to write down this link on the fly. But just to walk through at a high level what we mentioned in that blog, we went through the common mistakes that we see in data mapping in the industry. I think probably the first one is going the technology route before defining your legal requirements. And as I mentioned, you know, consultants can play a really valuable role here, but where legal understands the consequences and where a large motivator of doing this exercise is legal compliance, you have to start from the point of where do we need to be from a legal perspective, and then have the lawyers and the consultants and the technology folks talk to each other to translate that into a pragmatic process. Similarly, manual surveys. The initial kind of privacy compliance software that came out when GDPR made its debut a few years ago wasn't index stuff. It was the software that allows you to send out a survey to all of your system owners and have them report the personal information in their systems and the processing activities that they partake in. I think surveys are really important. Having that interaction with your business owners and your IT owners is really valuable because you have to find a way to make them own the consequences of the decisions they make about data. But the reality is that it's very hard to get good information from manual surveys. When they're designed by lawyers, like I said, we often phrase things that we don't realize are really hard for IT people to understand and answer. These people are also busy. They have a million things to do. They might not have time. We might not give them enough time to do the surveys. And if it's not a well-designed survey, you're not going to get good results back. I see a lot of surveys that come back with NA, I don't know, just no question, no response put in at all when something was a difficult question. And if you get a number of those back, your survey becomes useless. Our recommendation is to utilize surveys in combination with technological tools that can crawl your network and crawl your critical databases in order to discover information. It's also helpful, I think, to think when you're doing data mapping. It's really hard to know 100% of the information in your organization. But depending on your organization, you may have four databases that make up 75%. So start there. Worry about the masses and where you're going to get the most bang for your buck, and worry about documenting what's in those big databases. And then you can go out and worry about all of the other rocks that you've yet to turn over. But if you might be able to get 75% of consent compliance without doing some of those massive broad strokes if you focus on your critical databases. It's also important when you're designing this data mapping process, if you think of this as we're going to do a survey once and then never again because everyone's going to be really frustrated with us for having spent their time on this survey, it's almost not worth doing because the minute your process is done, it's going to be out of date because tomorrow somebody else is going to come in and install a new program or implement a new arrangement with a cloud provider, and your data map is going to be out of date. And as well as the GDPR didn't say document your data processes in 2018. It says have a processing register that describes your processing activities at all times. I don't read that to say, every single day you have to wake up and update your processing register, but I do read that to say that you have to monitor what data you have on an ongoing basis and put yourself in a position so that if a regulator said, I'm coming in 2 weeks to do a privacy audit, you could get there in a very short period of time. Another challenge that you'll experience in data mapping is the fact that so much data has moved to the cloud. And this is not just a data mapping challenge, this is a records management and a data management challenge as well, because I think there's often a tendency to say, that's stored with a vendor, we don't have to worry about that, we don't control that, that's not our problem. The reality is that it is your problem and it is your data, and one thing that we are seeing consistently in both privacy and security laws is an increased effort by legislatures to make organizations take responsibility, not just for the data that sits in their data centers, but for the data that they collect and use in their business on a daily basis, but is stored with somebody else. The cloud can also be particularly challenging because depending on how you're doing your survey or your technology indexing, it might not work in the cloud. And that's a really important question to ask when you're looking at technology tools is how is this going to find all of the places where I've sent the data outside of my company? Finally, make sure you're thinking about how you're going to handle unstructured data. By unstructured data, I mean both electronic communications as well as information that's stored in shared drives or basically any place that's not a database format. There are two real challenges from a privacy compliance perspective with this data. One is that it's not stored in a way that lets you know what the data is. Even when you have groups that are particularly vigilant about creating folder structures on shared drives, a human error or lack of human time often causes information to get in the wrong place, and you can't rely on where it is. The other problem is that personal information might get mentioned in these documents or utilized in ways that are not predictable. And dealing with that from the perspective of access and deletion requests can be really challenging. There's no easy answers here, but it is important when you're sketching out your data mapping project to make sure you're thinking through what you're going to do with all of this data that is really difficult to understand. So it looks like we have a question, which I'll read out loud. What are your thoughts on the importance of data segmentation regarding commingling of data? For example, business and protected health information. I think it really depends on your organization and the specifics of how that information is used. where you have certain pieces of information that are subject to heightened security requirements, segmentation is often a really valuable way to achieve that. Credit card data is the best example of that. The PCI DSS requirements require that the systems that are involved in the processing of payment card data be logically separated from the rest of your network. And that can also be really important for health information. It can be a great way of keeping things from being misused. I also think that you can drive yourself crazy trying to segment based on every individual risk. I've had clients look at, you know, should we be segmenting California resident data, for example, to make sure that we have the right security around that and to make it easier to do access requests. And the concern there would be that, you know, the minute you create segmentation for one set of data, that a new law comes down the pipeline and now you have to create a segment for a different set of data. So it's going to depend at the end of the day on whether you commingle those pieces of information for business purposes and need to be able to produce reports that include both, and whether you can create segments that, I don't use the word logical because that has technical implications, but that makes sense to put that data aside, and it allows you to achieve extra protections for data that is particularly sensitive without driving yourself crazy by having a network that is broken up into all these little pieces. While we're talking about data management policies, I think this is one of the places where a law firm can really drive value, is assisting our clients with writing policies, and again, doing so within the bounds of privilege. So we wanted to talk about what are the three data management policies you should have. We see a lot of different policies out there. You know, some are very necessary in every organization, some not so much. But we think there are three that you absolutely need these policies in order to do data management correctly. The first is a real records management policy. And what I mean by this is a records management policy that actually considers how you're going to implement ongoing deletion of data. If you want a schedule that says this type of data this many years, this type of data that many years, we are always happy to draft those for you. But the reality is that having a document that says keep your tax records for 6 years is fairly useless from an IT perspective. If they see a shared drive that has a bunch of PDFs, they do not know if those are tax records, and they do not know if a 6-year retention period applies and they can delete them. You have to provide employees with information about how to manage their data on a daily basis so that deletion can be applied on an ongoing basis. And that includes the format in which to store the data, so it's clear what's in it, what data needs to be stored in particular places versus what data they have the discretion to get rid of. And where they have the discretion to get rid of, you have to work with your employees to get them to actually do it. People do not part easily from their data. I will admit I am an email hoarder as well. I do not like to ever get rid of my email. I like to look back on it years and years and years. But the reality is I don't usually go back and look more than 2 or 3 years at my email because I've forgotten what I sent. Outlook doesn't manage it well. It takes me too long to find it. It's just easier to recreate it. And you have to be prepared to have ongoing and difficult conversations with people about why the old way of hoarding is not going to work anymore. And that needs to be embedded in company training and in company policies. If you don't take the time to work through implementation, the piece of paper that says keep something for this many years is going to be worked with. Records management also needs to be embedded into vendor contracts. More and more today, it's less data is getting stored on your network and it's getting farmed out elsewhere. And there's a huge tendency to say, well, it's over there, it's not my problem. Before you send data out of your network, you have to think about how you're going to manage that data, including how you are going to delete it when you no longer need it. And with a vendor, there's a huge misconception. Deletion when you no longer need it doesn't just mean when you break up with the vendor, you get your stuff back. That means if your retention period for the type of data that's created with that vendor is 5 years, that vendor needs to be applying a 5-year period on an ongoing basis, even if your relationship with them is continuing. The second policy that we would address, we would recommend you have, is data classification. A data classification policy, or sometimes it's called information classification, usually has 3 or 4 different categories, and it says all information should be classified in one of these. Then they look like things like public, internal only, confidential, highly confidential. The exact terminology that you use might vary depending on your company. The reason why this is important is because you have to tell employees where there are heightened sensitivities around data handling and what it is that they're actually supposed to do. And you have to do it in a way that they can execute it. Because if you tell them to label every Word document, but then you don't have a technology program that forces that, it's just not going to happen. People are too busy and they're going to forget. That's human nature. So again, you have to think through how this works in practice. The really important thing to note is that with the new privacy rules, your data classification policy needs to address how personal information is handled. And often this takes a little bit of gymnastics to do because where the state of California and the FTC, what they think is personal information, is really broad and is going to include email addresses and IP addresses and device addresses, where the data that might be really risky and that you're concerned about breach is going to be things that are more like social security numbers and payment card numbers and bank account numbers. And if you start writing policies that tell your employees you must encrypt all personal information, that's going to include email addresses, and people aren't going to take it seriously because you can't encrypt everything that has an email address. So it's important to work through in your classification policy where does personal information fit generally, and then what categories of personal information do you have that are heightened, and how do you want employees to treat them? Do you want them to not send them by emails in the first place? Do you have a secure email system that they should be using? Do you have password standards for encryption, et cetera? I recognize we're at the end of the hour here, but I promise we're right up at the end. Finally, contracts policy. And this goes hand in hand with what I said about vendor management and the importance of thinking through records that are going through your vendors. So often when we go to have the conversation with clients about the CCPA and GDPR contract requirements and how they're going to issue addenda for those, the response we get back is we don't know what contracts we have. Well, you need a policy where your data governance program knows, and in particular where your legal team is involved, because legal needs to make sure the contracts comply with good data management practices as well as emerging privacy law. Last substantive slide, the last one is just Q&A. We get a lot of people who want to kick off defensible deletion before January 1st because that's the CCPA implementation date. Definitely go for it, but I will warn you, as I already said, defensible disposal is typically a multi-year project, and if you don't already know what all your data is and what all your legal holds are, you might not get all the way there by January 1st. But please don't let that discourage you from trying. The less data you have on January 1st, the easier compliance is going to be, and you can continue to make it easier from there. Often we get asked, how do we deal with the requirements in GDPR and CCPA where consumers can request deletion? the best way to deal with these is to have robust deletion processes that ensure you don't have data that you don't need in the first place, and then allow you to rely on legitimate business uses to deny consumers requests for deletion. It's the best defense is a good offense strategy. We would highly recommend starting with low-hanging fruit, trying to draw circles around pockets that you of data that you clearly don't need and have no likelihood of having legal hold on that data, and seeing if you can get rid of those before January 1st. But as I mentioned, make sure that you are remediating your policy issues before you start large-scale deletion, because otherwise you will end up just in this same place a year from now, needing to spend more money on data mapping and remediation of data. Finally, don't forget to take the time to think about your legal hold in your defensible disposal process. It may be that you talk to your litigators and you find out you only have two as a company and it's not that big a deal. Great. If you are a highly litigious company or a company that's involved in a lot of litigations, chances are you will need to spend a good period of time documenting what legal holds you have. And I would strongly recommend getting a legal opinion that goes through the process that you went through to do that and says that that process follows best practices. Well, first, your process should actually follow best practices, but get an outside counsel to opine on the fact that you did, because if anything goes wrong and you face a spoliation claim later, spoliation is defeatable by good faith. And you need a memo that says that you acted in good faith and what you did was reasonable. So that's our rant on information governance. I know we're at the end of the hour. Happy to stick around for a few extra minutes to answer any questions you may have, or our email addresses are here, and feel free to reach out to us at any time. We also have a privacy and security blog where we regularly publish information about the California Consumer Privacy Act, GDPR, or other emerging topics, and I hope you'll all check it out.
If anyone has any other questions, please type them into the text box in the lower left corner of your screen and click on the send button. I do see one that's been typed into the public chat, so I will read it out for you, ladies. Mm-hmm. How about requirement for law firm business associate to, one, comply with the HIPAA minimum necessary standard, and two, protect attorney-client privilege and work product doctrine materials?
Yeah, can you repeat that? I'm not quite sure we're following.
Okay. How about the requirement for law firm business associates to, one, comply with the HIPAA minimum necessary standard, and two, protect the attorney-client privilege and work product doctrine materials?
Okay. Hold on one second, we're chatting. Yeah, I mean, I think we're a little bit confused as to the scope of the question because, you know, to us, if a law firm is acting as a business associate, you know, they need an agreement. I'll be honest, that's probably the extent of my HIPAA knowledge beyond that. And that's probably a very different issue than where the scope of attorney-client privilege is. If whoever had that question wants to email us, maybe we can dig in and get you a more useful answer.
Okay, I don't see any further questions. So if you'd like to give us your closing comments.
Yeah, I think we covered the closing comments on the last slide, just with the tips to get started on data deletion. So we'd just like to thank everybody for attending. We hope you found the presentation useful.
Thank you. A link to the online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few moments to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar, and thank you for attending.